Welcome to the third and final podcast in our series looking at the termination of commercial contracts. I'm Ben Longworth, a partner in our disputes resolution team.
And I'm Charlie Fursden, an associate also in our disputes resolution team.
In our previous podcasts, we looked at the grounds for terminating a contract and the mechanics of termination. In this episode, we're going to think about the implications of terminating a contract. That is a huge topic and one that litigators tend to relish, but you'll be relieved to hear that we're going to cover the key points in about 10 minutes. We're going to focus on three key areas. First, which contractual obligations survive termination. Secondly, the calculation of damages if a contract is terminated for breach. And thirdly, what can happen when a party gets termination wrong. We have also prepared a checklist setting out the main points to consider before terminating a contract, which aims to bring together the various strands we've covered in this series. The checklist is now available on our website, and we hope it's a useful practical starting point if you encounter any issues with your contracts. Of course, that's no substitute for taking legal advice on the specific circumstances of your case, so please do get in touch with us if that's what you need. We'd be very happy to help. So, Charlie, can you start by explaining the immediate effect of terminating a contract?
The effect of termination on a contract is basically the same whether the termination right arose at common law, i.e. because of a repudiatory breach by one party, or under the terms of the contract, i.e. a termination clause. The key point is that termination does not undo a contract as if it had never existed. That is known as rescission, and only arises in very limited circumstances, generally relating to defective formation of a contract. Instead, the contract still exists, but from the date of termination, both parties are normally released from their primary obligations under the contract. So, in a contract for services, the service provider is no longer obliged to provide services, and the other party is no longer obliged to pay for them. However, certain contractual obligations survive the termination. These generally relate to what are known as secondary obligations, which tend to be ancillary to the subject matter of the contract. Typically, these might be duties relating to confidentiality, record keeping, indemnities, or the governing law or jurisdiction that applies if there is a dispute arising out of the contract. Important rights which have accrued before termination can also survive. That may be as straightforward as the right of a party to be paid for goods or services provided under the contract, but it can also include rights relating to intellectual property, restrictive covenants, or liquidated damages, among others. How long these rights and obligations survive will depend principally on any express term of the contract, but will ultimately be restricted by statutory limitation periods. The continuation of these clauses tends to make good sense. They can have considerable value to the parties, particularly following the end of the contractual term, but that value tends to make them ripe for disputes.
Absolutely, and that's one reason why when drafting a contract, it's important to pay close attention to the so-called boilerplate clauses. They often aren't given as much attention as the main commercial terms in a contract, but they can have a really big impact on whether and how the parties can enforce their rights after termination. All contracts will come to an end eventually, so it's really important to think at the outset about those circumstances to reduce the scope for disputes. So, for example, some contracts include a clause known as a survival clause that says expressly that certain obligations survive termination. That can be helpful, but it can also create uncertainty. The starting point is usually that rights that have accrued before termination survive, even without a survival clause. Now, understandably, parties often want to make that point clear, but if the survival clause says that rights under specific clauses survive, but it doesn't mention the rights deriving from other clauses, there may be scope for one party to question whether the unmentioned clauses survive or not, and that gives litigators an opportunity to try and argue the point. We're getting slightly ahead of ourselves. I'd like to go back, if we could, and look at the consequences of different types of termination. Of course, there are plenty of contracts that come to an end either at the end of the contractual term or when one party terminates on notice under the terms of the contract. But Charlie, you and I are much more likely to get involved when a contract is terminated for breach. So I wonder if you could set out the position on termination where one party has breached the contract.
Well, the first point to note is that a party in breach of contract will be liable for damages arising from that breach, whether or not there is a right to terminate, and whether or not the contract is actually terminated. The basic principle is that damages should put the innocent party into the position they would have been in if the contract had been properly performed. But the quantification of damages is a huge topic and not one we can fully do justice to in this podcast. The sum to be paid in damages will ultimately depend on whether the contract is terminated and on what grounds. Sticking to the position on termination, as that is the subject of this podcast, there are two categories of losses to think about. The first is losses caused directly by the breach. In a straightforward claim, the losses might be a sum that the other party hasn't paid under the contract, or it could include the costs of investigating the breach or a loss of profit. The second category is damages caused by the fact that the contract has been terminated, sometimes called loss of contract damages or expectation loss. Loss of contract damages are based on the premise that, but for the breach, the contract would have continued to be performed until the end of the contractual period, or until it could have been terminated for convenience. The innocent party may therefore claim damages for the profits it would have made had the contract been performed up to that point. It's important to note that the ability to claim loss of contract damages may depend on the grounds for termination relied upon, in particular whether the breach would justify termination for repudiatory breach at common law. If a party is entitled to terminate a contract for even a minor breach, and it does so, and that minor breach wasn't serious enough to be a repudiatory breach, it may not be able to claim loss of contract damages and would be restricted to claiming losses that arise directly from the breach itself. However, the general rule, subject to any contrary provision in the contract, is that if the breach that triggers termination is a repudiatory breach, the aggrieved party can get damages for loss of contract even if it actually terminates using a contractual termination right.
Yeah, that's right. And I just want to reiterate that the drafting of a contract can be critical here. Charlie, you've explained the general rule, but as you said, contracts can vary the position. So, for example, many contracts include a fixed or liquidated damages clause to compensate the aggrieved party for loss of the contract. And if that sort of clause has been agreed, the aggrieved party will have the right to those damages, even if the breach that triggers the claim would not be a repudiatory breach at common law. It's worth bearing in mind, too, with our litigator hats on, that the courts are likely to look particularly closely at a compensation clause that produces a very different result from the common law. The general principle that a so-called penalty clause is invalid remains, but that rule has been relaxed somewhat in recent years. So, for example, a fixed damages clause can now be valid even if it's intended as a deterrent against breach, as long as that deterrence is proportionate to a party's interests in securing performance. So coming back to our chronology of termination, an aggrieved party may terminate the contract by giving notice to the other party and claim for damages. In practical terms, subject to any specific dispute resolution mechanism set out in the contract, there is usually a certain amount of correspondence and negotiation between the parties about whether damages are due, and if so, the amount. And if the issue can't be resolved, it can escalate into formal pre-action correspondence and ultimately the issue of proceedings or triggering an arbitration. Once things get to formal pre-action correspondence, if you haven't already taken legal advice, it certainly makes sense to do so. We often get involved at a relatively early stage and we can help strengthen the negotiating position and also make sure that any procedural requirements are met. It's also important to remember that it's not just the party that has allegedly breached the contract that needs to tread carefully. Charlie, what should the terminating party bear in mind?
Well, the first point to note is that terminating a contract without a right to do so is likely to amount to a repudiatory breach of contract, which the other party could accept and then sue for damages. An overly aggressive approach can therefore quickly turn a strong position into a much weaker one, and, as we have discussed in the last podcast, a notice of termination can't be rescinded once given, so there is no going back. It sounds basic, but when terminating, it's also important to make sure you understand exactly what you're doing and on which basis, and that you get the procedure right in doing so. Otherwise, you can risk missing out on valuable claims or counterclaims. As we have discussed, the issue of whether the terminating party can claim damages for loss of the contract, in addition to loss caused directly by the breach, may depend on the grounds invoked at the point of termination. One salutary tale is the litigation between Phones for You and EE from 2018. EE invoked a contractual termination right when Phones for You went into administration, citing the specific clause in the contract which permitted termination in those circumstances. However, it didn't terminate for what it later alleged was Phones for You's repudiatory breach, i.e. ceasing to trade. The termination notice had not suggested that Phones for You had materially breached the contract. EE therefore wasn't able to claim damages for the loss of the contract, which reduced its claim by about £200 million.
Wow, that really is a salutary tale. And you can see why it was superficially attractive to rely on a contractual right to terminate, because presumably there was then no question about whether or not they had the right to terminate. But clearly it would have been worth a significant fight about whether or not there was a repudiatory breach, given that £200 million was at stake. So to draw the strands together, the EE case highlights a point that has run through all three episodes of the podcast, which is that it's vital before terminating a contract to take a step back and ensure you get it right. That includes thinking about the grounds for termination, whether it's preferable to exercise a contractual or common law termination right, and what formalities you need to follow. Even if the other party has quite clearly breached their contractual obligations, there are a number of legal issues and tactical factors to think about before you press the button to terminate. Whatever the circumstances, do think about seeking legal advice at an early stage. That doesn't have to be a hugely costly exercise. We certainly won't throw the kitchen sink at something unless that's needed and you're happy for us to do so. Our goal is always to help resolve disputes as quickly and efficiently as possible. We can help you understand how the law applies to the specifics of your case, and it can be very helpful to get an outsider's perspective, particularly where you've been closely involved in the negotiation or the performance of the contract itself. Before we sign off, just to remind you that our checklist of points to consider when terminating a contract is available on our website now. We hope you found these podcasts interesting and helpful, and thank you very much for listening.